Thank you all for joining us. I appreciate it. I know you just came back from spring break and you're still getting into the swing of things. So this is a treat for us all to get to talk with Professor Nguyen today. You know, I have to say, she is one of these people who makes me feel like such a slacker because, you know, many academics, you know, say that they work at the intersection of this thing and the other thing. But you will see and you will understand, and I hope, you know, feel free when we open up for Q&A to ask her about herself and her work. But she does such an interesting combination of areas. You know, started out, like me, she practiced at a big firm. She was in New York, I was in Boston. And, you know, she has a wonderful mix of not only domestic, but an international focus as well. She has expertise in the intersection of commercial law, financing, intellectual property, bankruptcy, and IP and taxation. So, you know, I came to know her through our IP world, but really she has sort of, I think, epitomizes, you know, the innovation ecosystem, right, and all that it takes with IP and sort of all the transactional aspects and the many, you know, she's written, you know, I think over a dozen books on secured transactions, international intellectual property, intellectual property taxation, transnational intellectual property, licensing, and about a million articles on everything else in between. besides that, and numerous awards, she is also a senior consultant for the World Bank, and so she does really interesting projects in China, Vietnam, and other countries, and consulting for various governmental agencies, and is really quite instrumental in helping with advising on financing and other kinds of transactions, which of course you can also ask her about for those of you who are interested. So this brings us to why you will see that she has come to write this really important work about disruption, right? A word we hear a lot about. And in particular, the theme of disruption, which we will talk about, not only reflected in her work on Silicon Valley Bank, but also some articles on blockchain and other, you know, all that stuff as well that I know nothing about. But we will talk about that, and you can, as I said, feel free to, we'll try to keep this as informal as possible. Pitch a few questions about the book to sort of get us started. But really, you know, I want you to have a conversation and be part of the conversation with her. So whatever questions occur to you, whatever your backgrounds are that bring you here for the hour that we're here, please feel free to chime in and participate. And also at the end, for those of you who have books, she will be happy to autograph those as well. So welcome. Welcome to UVA. This is her first time here and in Charlottesville, and we ordered beautiful weather to go with it. So welcome, Professor Nguyen.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much to all of you for attending this event. And I want to say thank you to you, Professor Rowe. Professor Rowe and I, we have known each other for almost 20 years. And she is absolutely, you know, she's a first-rate scholar and also a very, very dear friend. We met each other at the People of Color Scholarship Conference back then. And many of you do not know, Professor Rowe, before she entered Legal Academy, she was a partner at the Big Law. very few law professors in the entire United States partner at a big law firm to leave practice and become a full-time law professor. What does that mean? She brought with her a wealth, experience, knowledge, and that's why her scholarship and her teaching at UVA, I know many of you in this room here, you are her students, you are so fortunate, and I am fortunate to be her colleague and her friend. And so with that, Professor Rowe, Elizabeth, thank you so much for having me here.
You're welcome. You're very kind, very kind. Thank you all. And so let's start by telling us kind of what inspired you to want to take on this project. What was it about this bank that made you think, oh, I don't have enough to do, let me write a whole book about it?
Thank you. That's a great question. So many of you probably know that patents, copyrights, trademarks. So when you have a small company and it has intellectual property, the small company will need a loan and they need to get lending from some sources, right? So, but if you go to a bank, any bank in the United States or outside the United States itself, no bank in this country will give you a loan based on intellectual property. And why is that? And so I had this question with me for a long, long time. And so I spent some time to look into it. Why banks in the United States do not make loans, do not give loans to young startup companies? And so that was the impetus, reason. Who among the banks are the disruptor to disrupt this kind of antiquated thinking that intellectual property, yes, it's valuable, but we're not going to accept them for any loans at all. Mm-hmm. So that was the driving force for me to find out among the thousand of banks and the whole history of banking in the United States, and to find who's the outliers, who the disruptors here. And because without banks, which means no loans and no stop, we'll be able to make that particular move at the very, very beginning itself. So that's some of the impetus in the background, why that led me to try to search for the disruptor, if you will. And in fact, back at Free Frank, where I practiced law in New York City, so Free Frank, Harris, Shriver, and Jacobson, it's in New York City, and at that law firm, when I was a young, summer associate at the law firm itself, and I had an assignment, and the assignment was that look into taking the intellectual property as collateral for loans. And back then, as any 2L, what? Intellectual property is already new. And then taking that as collateral for a loan, that is such a new idea. And then the assignment from the partner, the partner didn't know the answer, so they give to you the youngest person, right? And so I did the research, and then that's when I discovered that, wow, the use of intellectual property in financing, as collateral in financing, for those of you who have taken or going to take secure transaction law, UCC Article 9, and you will find out that you can use many property as collateral for financing, but using intellectual property as collateral for financing, how do you do that? How do you do that, right? And so that was the reason behind my research when I was a 2L, to do research and to understand what's the history of using intellectual property for financing in the United States itself. So that's just some broad background leading to the book. But it took more than 20-some years to come to this book.
Yeah.
So it took 2L years to come to this book.
Oh, better late than never, for sure.
Exactly.
So what did you find about Silicon Valley Bank? I often find that, as many of us who followed anything Silicon Valley, if you've watched, the Uber documentary or, any of those that we can find, usually they become, stories of things gone bad. It's about the people. So tell us a little bit about who the people were here who had this innovative idea in and of itself, to decide, hey, there's this you know, area of tech that, that maybe we can service.
Right. And so if thank you for that question relating to who were the, essentially the brain, you know, who has the idea behind establishing a bank itself. So back then, when you look at the 1970s, Silicon Valley Bank was so new. I mean, Silicon Valley itself was new. And so if you look at Santa Clara, at that time, Santa Clara did not produce tech companies. They was producing apricots, plums. That's what Santa Clara Valley was for. It was for a lot of plums. And at that moment, Stanford University, right? And so Stanford University beginning, particularly after World War II, and the U.S. defense industry was blooming in Southern California itself. So Stanford University at that moment attracting lots of students from outside the United States and also domestically. And among the students who came to Stanford, they asked their professor by the name of Robert Medeiros. He taught construction engineering. But in his construction engineering, there was financing component. And at that time, construction was the interface of technology, engineering, technology, and also financing. And so the student at Stanford, they asked the professor, when we have ideas, why banks do not provide us loans for our ideas? And the professor did not have the answer. And so he kept asking around why banks did not provide loans to his brilliant student from Stanford. And so finally he decided that he going to teach himself everything about banking sectors itself. And so, and then he spoke to experts. And so among the experts that he spoke to, there was Bill and Bill Bickerstaff, who was a banker at that time. And so Bill Bickerstaff, and he gave consultant services to Medeiros. And then the two men was introduced to the third person by the name of Roger Smith. Roger Smith was a president of a bank. And Roger Smith, he himself, at that moment, he was president of a bank, but it was a branch of a small bank. Okay? Roger Smith wanted to do something about providing loans to new tech companies in the late 70s itself. So here the confluence of three men who want to come together and serve a new community that's so new and so young. And that's in fact, when they decided that to form a bank, the name Silicon Valley was available. The name Silicon Valley was available. And so that's why they named their bank Silicon Valley Bank. Nobody wanted to touch the name Silicon Valley because, like I told you, apricots and plums. And in fact, some people back then told them, don't select the name Silicon Valley Bank because it's so provincial. It's so provincial. Nobody will know us. Why don't you select a name like at least California Bank or American Bank or U.S. Bank, something that's bigger, right? So the three of them got together. But here, you know, in order to provide financing to tech companies, the bank must have money, number one. So where's the money coming from? And number two, to disrupt that, quote unquote, disrupt. Back then, we did not use that verb at all. There's no such thing as disruption. But they know one thing, that the community is going to be small. But we need everybody in the community together to nurture tech companies. And so therefore, they decide that instead of asking one or two people to be investors in the bank, they decide from the very beginning that to invite 100 investors. And 100 investors of who and who and who at that moment, including last name like Sonsini, Larry Sonsini. And that's one of the top banks nowadays, right? Nowadays, you know, Wilson Sonsini. But Wilson Sonsini was just a tiny, tiny law firm at that time. But Larry Sonsini was an important person in the community. And so the three gentlemen, particularly Roger Smith, he was so convinced that because any young companies will need a network of supporters. And so therefore, they got 100 leaders in the community. Who and who and who? Politician, check. Accountants, check. Law firm partners, checks. Any new financial institution at that moment, i.e. VC. The term VC was not invoked at that time, but they also invited anybody who's VCs as well. So they create a network of 100 supporters, and each person was asked, please, to invest in this new bank, $10,000 per person. Many of them, that told me that was the best investment in their life.
I'll say, yeah.
Years later.
Yeah.
And so the ingredients, you know, the ingredients for the bank with the three personalities, that the three personalities of Roger Smith, Robert Medeiros, and Bill Bickerstaff, they themselves decided to form this bank. But the brainchild was with Medeiros. Mm-hmm. The person who executed is Roger Smith, to bring together 100 investors, $10,000 per person, to pull in and provide the network of support to tech companies itself. And then finally, before they can open the bank, they got in total. They got money from a bigger investor, and so they opened the bank with $5 million, and it has one office in the middle of nowhere. And here's the best part of disruption, right? Instead of open the bank near Stanford, they say, we don't have the money to do that. So let's open it far away in an industrial park, isolated from everybody, okay? And so, which means that they have to work harder, which means whoever they're going to hire have to work harder. And they also decided they're not going to spend any money for advertisement. Because why? Because they didn't have the money. But what did they do before they opened, before the October day's opening? The personality came out, the three personalities came out. They decided to invite one of the investors. Remember the 100 investors? So one of the investors was a congressman. And then to have him to put, make sure at the opening of the bank, the congressman put on a bunny suit, the clean suit. Back then, in the computer age, you know, when you're talking about computer chips, you talk about the clean room, or the, you know, so you have to put on the space suit or the bunny suit. And so one of the photographers was there, took the picture of the congressman being housed by a bank, by one of the bankers, to put on the suit, and that picture was viral, but back then we did not have the term viral, right? And so the picture was picked up by local media, and that's how they get that promotion, that innovative free marketing. And again, the personalities of these three men, they was remarkable, that they was functioning just like they themselves, founders of a startup.
Right.
Startup means lean, has no money, no resources. Startup need the network of people and need to begin that way. So it's in the DNA from the very beginning, from the inception,
right,
that they need to function and behave just like their future client startup. And they have to figure out a way to disrupt what the system at that time as well.
And this part of the system was sort of dealing with the network of regulations, right, that governed regular banks and some of those hurdles that were involved. Can you tell us more about that? How was this going to be different?
Yeah. And so thank you for that question. Any of us, if you in the banking sector, is one of the most, I would say, highly regulated sector in the United States. Why? Because banks don't have money. Bank money comes from you, right? Banks' money comes from depositors. And so, which means we, the public, demand that the banks heavily regulated. And so therefore, because when the bank is so heavily regulated, we have regulation that determine what will be calculated or acceptable as collateral. This chair here might be deemed as collateral, but intellectual property is not included in the definition of collateral, because the regulation said that only, you know, certain items, certain kind of property will be accepted as collateral. So which means the majority of banks, if not, I use a number, 99.9% of banks in the United States will not, at this moment, will not count intellectual property in the definitions of collateral when they do valuations, when they do the calculation to give you a loan. And so let's say a loan is $5 million or a loan is $10 million. But if the intellectual property has nice value, the bank will say, sorry, we don't dare to violate the regulation, so therefore we cannot accept intellectual property in the calculation for the borrowing base. And so because of that, because functioning in that particular space, how could then, that was a big question for me, how could bank, Silicon Valley Bank, able to persuade the regulators? How did they do it? Because to write this book, I interviewed many different banks, you know, and also because of my roles as a senior consultant for the World Bank. So I spoke to many banks in these countries and also to banks outside the United States, bank in Canada as well. And so same practice, whether you're in Canada, you're in China, you're in the United States, banks are so conservative, they will not do it because the regulation, the law. And so when I interviewed the founder for Silicon Valley Bank, the original founder. I flew out to Davis. One of them was in the nursing home, you know, because we talk about the bank was founded 40 years ago, right? And then the original founder and also the first banker as well. So I want to know how did each one of them able to persuade the regulators to allow them to provide services to the tech industry to make loans to startup. So what they did was fascinating. They themselves, the bankers, they, first of all, they persuaded the VC, the who and who VC. If you're in this room, you know Sequoia. Sequoia VC, large national global VC. Kleiner Perkins. Giant. So all the top VC in the world itself. So they asked each of those VC to help them to have face-to-face meeting with the regulators and to explain to the regulator what exactly the VC ecosystem's about. Because the regulators, even though they think they are smart, but they don't know. Even they think they're so smart, but they don't know what exactly and how the VC ecosystem works at all. And so that is why it took actually months, if not years, sitting down to explain to the regulators about the VC ecosystem, which means the money coming from the funds, investors, and investors put their money in funds, and then the VC going to invest in portfolio companies, by the way. Only what, about 1% of all startups will be able to get VC money. And so if you talk about 100 new startups today, new companies today, then somewhere between about 5 companies will be able to get VC funding. And so then it goes from funds to the new portfolio companies here. So the portfolio companies will be able to get, let's say, the first Series A funding. So the Series A funding, let's say the check is $10 million, and the company is able to survive for 18 months to go to the next Series B. But in between the series, go to A to B, more than half of companies will die. So less than 5%, 1 to 5% will be selected for VC financing, but go from A to B series, half of them or more will survive, will die, and will survive here, right? And so to go from A to B, many times companies will need a loan We need a loan to bridge them, to bring them over, right? And so bank has a role to play right here, right? And because VC providing the funding for the company, VC really wants the company to survive to Series B. So it's in the VC best interest, in the VC best interest, that the VC willing to, quote unquote, guarantee the loans without signing any contracts. So the VC, like Sequoia, will say that, I am so glad Silicon Valley Bank, you're going to provide loan to my portfolio company so then they can survive from A to B. Please give them a loan. We use our reputation backing this company here, but we are not going to sign the guarantee for the loan, but we're using our reputation as Sequoia to back in the company. And so Sequoia and all explained it to the regulators that the VC themselves, before they make selection among the thousand of new companies, they conduct due diligence. And those due diligence are more than typical banks' due diligence. They do much more work. Right. So therefore, they essentially persuade the regulators, say, relax a little bit here. We VC do conduct the due diligence. The bank is not conducting due diligence. We are standing behind these portfolio companies here, and so therefore the loans are safe here, or at least are safer here. Mm-hmm. So these persuasions that they was able to convince the regulators to let Silicon Valley Bank to have a business model devoted literally over time 100% to serving tech companies itself. Right. And that was one ingredient. And the second ingredient was that there was so much money come from the VC, and so typically that only about 40 to 50% of the deposit will leave the bank as loans. So the ratio is really low. So there's a lot of money as still sitting as deposit, and only half of it will go out as loans. Versus a traditional bank, you can have up to 85% of the deposit money going to loans itself. So therefore, the regulator saw that, so give them some comfort. And also in the early days as well, that the bankers, they have to sit down with the regulators and to show to the regulators every single loan and how each of the loan by each of the new young tech companies will be repaid by account receivables, by the products coming in. So let's say Fitbits, you know, are you wearing, what kind of?
I have an Apple Watch.
You have Apple Watch. So any of you have Fitbits, right? And so imagine that making a loan to Fitbits, and Fitbits was indeed Silicon Valley Bank client. So Silicon Valley Bank will have to convince a regulator, look, this young company here has products, and it has cash flow. And so it has to demonstrate it every single time itself. And so they used to complain to me that the regulator would just camp out at the headquarter, you know, for weeks to look at every single loan itself.
So once they were up and running, I'm looking at the clock because I want to be sure I allow enough time for questions.
Sorry, I got
that's all right. So once they were up and running, what were they able to achieve? So given that sort of part of the reason for starting, part of the motivation was the kind of, you know, change tech lending and all of that, what would you say were some of the successes? Were they able to achieve that before we get to obviously the other side.
Okay. First of all, that they, one of the key achievements, I believe, that they are able to prove everybody in the United States and the world wrong. That tech lending, that they're able to prove tech lending is very profitable, and they did that. They did it successfully to show that. Mm-hmm. And one of the key products was venture debt. Any of you in business schools, you know, have the background relating to venture debt. Venture debt was the kind of loans that Silicon Valley Bank established. And so you look at BlackRock today. BlackRock has a huge, huge, you know, devotions, you know, in venture debt itself. So it came from Silicon Valley Bank. And venture debt means that you are giving loans to VC-backed company so they can go to the next rounds of funding itself, so venture debt. So that's key, that's one. So they prove that, you know. They also prove, number two, that actually is very safe. It's very safe in the tech lending space. That's contrary to everybody's out there thinking about that. So that is key. And also, number three, that they are able to prove that in this ecosystem itself, that you do need to have a bank that serves everyone in the ecosystem, from the founder, the executive team, the investor who are VC, the fund themselves, okay? And also when the founders need a home, they go to the bank. When the investor when the capital call for the next loans, they also need a bank. So you need a bank that who serve everybody in the ecosystem and understand how the ecosystem itself works. So they're able to prove those ingredients before them. Nobody figured that out at all. So that's to me the remarkable achievements that they did. And they went from being a community bank, one office in the middle of nowhere, northern part of San Jose, to become the 13th largest bank in the United States before the collapse itself. That's quite, I say, a story, is, you know, from rag to riches. So that's, you know, that's quite remarkable that they became the, you know, top 15 bank in the country before the collapse itself.
So let's get to the collapse.
Oh God!
what's juicy about the collapse? What do we need to know? What happened? Right. In short, I'm sure it's a long,
right.
complicated story.
Sure. So first of all, the collapse. I still remember the moment when I heard about the collapse. I was just so sad, and for the first time in my life, to in my professional career writing law review articles and books, first time in my life that I was so stunned to the point that I was numbed. I did not know what to do. The first hour, I did not know how to respond to it, because I knew the innovators so well, and I knew what they have done to achieve where they were, and the collapse, I would say that it's its own Shakespearean tragedy. I use the term Shakespearean, and I meant it. Because just right before that, the year before, the 2 years before that, when I conducted the interviews, I mean a year and a half, they were just a very vibrant bank, successful bank, and yet what happened here? So the juicy part of the collapse itself, like the juicy part, put aside my personal feeling about it, and that's I think that the tech bro of Silicon Valley is responsible for killing their own bank. I say that emphatically. You know, the tech bros of Silicon Valley are responsible for killing their own bank.
Because
first of all, is that the tech bros think that they are so smart. They think that they're so smart. They think that they understand how banks work. They don't. They don't understand how banks work. And that's one of the key problems. They don't understand how banks work. They do not understand that banks in the business of taking deposits and give out loans. And banks are heavily regulated, and that in the regulated industry, the bank must invest the deposits in very safe, very boring investments, i.e. US Treasuries. and so Silicon Valley Bank did just that. But because the central bank increased rates very rapidly in such a short time, that caused the investment that Silicon Valley Bank did in very safe in the treasuries itself. You know, that's half this on paper that there's a loss. But that loss is small and it can be easily cured. But tech bros didn't understand that. Tech bro did not understand that at all. And so because tech bro didn't understand that, and what the tech bro did, what tech bro did is that, let me have any cell phone here. I didn't have the cell phone with me. So may have this cell phone. So what the tech bro did is that they use this cell phone here. They amplify their messages to their bubbles, to the people in their bubbles. So they send out messages and communicate it to their portfolio companies who are in their bubbles. And then they're telling all the portfolio companies, take your money out. And when they did that, they killed the bank. How so? If you and I, if you want to go to Chase Bank, any of you in this room, if you go to Chase Bank today or tomorrow and say that you want to take out $20,000, Chase Bank will not allow you. Right? But Silicon Valley Bank, because they serve the tech communities, any tech companies, you can take out millions and millions, millions with a click of your cell phone. And because tech bro told the portfolio companies, take your money out, they started a bank run. Chase Bank will not allow you to start a bank run because they don't allow you to take the money out. Silicon Valley Bank allowed you to take your money out. And when the tech bro tell the portfolio companies, you have to understand the thank you, Professor Rowe. So in the VC ecosystem, you have the VCs up here commanding heights, I say. And when they tell you run, you run. That's how it works. And so therefore, these companies, the portfolio companies, they have herd mentality. You know, I call them sheep, you know. Herd mentality. That, and they follow. And that's what they did. And so in total, Professor Rowe, $142 billion to leave the bank in less than 48 hours. The shortest bank run in the history. Okay? And so you can see then that the tech bro, not understanding how banking works, not understanding other factors, okay, that why Silicon Valley Bank on paper was suffering a loss on paper, but not understanding all those so-called losses, you know, in all those so-called losses on paper caused by the interest hikes, the rapid interest hike, and that all the monies, the deposit money was so saved in treasuries itself here, all right? And yet not understanding, and they use social media in their own bubble to tell the portfolio companies to take the money out.
So where does that leave us with lessons learned other than, you know?
Sure. So that's,
slow down and wait.
Yeah. So there's several lessons, very valuable lessons here, you know, definitely. For the banking sectors, the control social media itself, to understand that social media is a risk to banking. Before this, we never imagined that social media is a risk, is a risk. We think of, oh, not having collateral, so the loan's a risk, but social media is a risk. Mm-hmm. That they can see that, so you can see that how rumors, when it's so isolated and insulated at the same time in bubbles,
yeah.
That it can cause, you know, can cause the bank's reputation, can be tanked very quickly. In this case here, can create its own bank run.
Right.
So that's one. And then that's also that for banks to have very very strong policy relating to withdrawals. Mm-hmm. You serve in tech company, the lesson learned here is that gonna be tighter control by banks, not allowing tech company to withdraw so easily when you serve tech companies. You know, just by the phone, they can move $100 million here, $100 million there. regular banks, they don't allow that. But any banks going to step in this void going to have tighter control relating to what, how much they going to allow tech companies to withdraw their money. So that's another lesson itself as well. And I think that the third lesson here is that it's going to be quite painful for the VC, and they have experienced the pain already. The lesson they learned is that they don't know how banks operate, and to avoid killing the next bank, okay, that they need to be a little bit more humble. That's the lesson that they learned. They need a little bit more humble here. That just because you VC, you back some incredible tech companies from the early days of Apples to Uber to everybody else. You know, you think that's because, you know, if you know that you think that you VC on top of the world. And we have seen that. You know, we have seen that the behaviors of the VC themselves, they think that they dominate, right? And I think it's backfire. So the lesson learned from that one is that whichever bank going to operate in this voice here, that they need to be able to work with VC in such a way, quote unquote, to educate the VC, but the VC need to be humble, to willing to learn that, look, this is how banking system works here. And for any bank to willing to step in this void, then the VC needs that bank, but the VC also needs to work with that bank, but not to essentially exert the kind of insulas, you know, the kind of control that they did and create such a rumor mills itself to do that. So that's some of the key big lesson for the banking sectors, but for the regulators, you know, the really funny part is that when the bank collapsed, in D.C., the key regulator did not even know the name Silicon Valley Bank, and admitted that the regulator did not even know that Silicon Valley Bank existed. Wow. The whole Silicon Valley ecosystem, without Silicon Valley Bank, there would be none of them. And yet, our regulator in DC did not even know. I'm sure the regulators in San Francisco knew, you know, but there's no communications. And so the lesson also for the regulator in DC to learn is that different sectors, the economy, needs certain banks to serve them, but the regulator needs to keep an eye on sector specific. When we talk about banking services, on the one hand, understand the business and allow them to provide loans. On the other hand, understand that when the government hiking rates so quickly, how it's going to impact specific industry much more than the overall industries out there itself. So that's a kind of lesson for the regulator to keep in mind to do that. So that's pretty much, that's more, but I'm going to stop here.
Thank you so much for attending.